Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the GLP Q4 FY15 Investors Conference. At this time and for the duration of the conference, all phone participants are in a listen-only mode. I would now like to hand the conference over to Ms. Ambika Goel. Thank you.
I'm going to hand it over to Ming now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambika, and good morning from Singapore. Thank you all for joining us. When I was told by Ambika that we're going to have a new setting on the earnings call, we're going to have live people watching us. When you guys ask questions, if I don't know it, she can't hand the tissue over to me anymore. Overall, I'm happy to report to you that for the whole year, our property operations, development, and fund management continue to be very strong. On the operation front, we achieved 93% on a global basis on lease-up. We have experienced rental growth in every market we operate in. Our development market continues to remain very strong. We completed $1.2 billion of development, with 88% of that being in China. We recognize $183 million development profit. We expect this to grow to double next year, about $2.3 billion completion. Again, the margins remain consistent with what we've seen. Our fund management continues to be strong. We now have over $20 billion AUM. Our fees, our management fees, is about $108 million. We expect to grow 50% to about $150 million this year. We expect that to continue to grow about another 50% next year to over $230 million. Operation, development, and fund management are a key part of our strategy and how we create the highest risk-adjusted value for our shareholders. After Steve and Heather go through the operation and financial reviews, I'll come back to you and explain how we create value in the development and how fund management helps fund the capital required to meet the demand of our customers while we enhance our returns. I'd like to take the opportunity to share with you what we see on the ground in each of the markets. Let's start with China. We currently have about 56% of our NAV invested in China, and we expect to continue to invest most of our equity into China going forward. Everyone probably continues to hear and read negative news and economic outlooks from China. Most people are concerned about the GDP growth and the amount of debt at the local government level. Again, most of these facts are somewhat true. We are seeing surplus capacity across many industries, and including our own. The days where you can build and they will come is pretty much over. Over the last two, 3 years, our sector has attracted a lot of attention. International and local developers, private equities around the world, local traditional residential developers getting in the game, even insurance companies are getting into our sector. As a result, we are seeing some temporary oversupply in some of our markets. What's our view about all this? For one, I think there's oversupply of capital into this market, into this sector. I would say some of them are not as disciplined. Two, if this happened 3 to 5 years ago, I'd probably be more nervous about it. Because with capital, you can buy land, you can build, and there'll be a glut of supply. But fortunately, over the last 3 to 4 years, the Chinese government have enforced a very strict land quota system that limits the amount of land, including industrial land, logistic land, that could be developed in each of the city. And that policy is very strictly enforced, and we experienced that very much. Over the last year, we've seen a decrease of 18% of industrial land released in the system year over year. So with that, on top of that, we're also seeing resettlement and farm relocations. It's becoming more protective of their rights. So the cost and also the time to resettle is preventing land easily converted for logistic development. So with all that, I'm quite optimistic. The midterm to long term, I still think supply and demand are quite healthy, despite all that. Third, I think As more and more people rushing into this sector, I think operation capabilities is becoming even more critical. And strong customer base, network effect is working to advantage. If you look at how, despite all this noises, all this slowdown, economic headwinds, we have recorded the strongest leasing quarter in the company's history last quarter. We leased out 1.2 million square meters of new and expansion leases in one quarter. Put that in perspective, that is equivalent to about 10,000 or 110,000 square feet of leasing a day, per day. Again, I think you know some of the people in the sector, they envy our leasing operation capabilities. What's more important is that the 1.2 million square meter of new leases we have done in the quarter, 72% of that come from our existing customers. So of all the new development, new competition, we only had to worry about 28% of that to find new customers for it. Again, with a strong customer base, we also have the ability to talk to our customers. They share with us what the requirement for the next 3-5 years, where they need it, how much space they need, and what price they want to pay for that location. So we have a pretty good visibility of what the requirement will be for the next 2 or 3 years. And currently, we still continue to have a healthy backlog of over 8 million square meters of demand in this market. So despite all the noises and all the economic numbers, we still have a pretty good confidence about the demand continuing to be quite strong. But again, I would have no issue with slowing down our development pipeline as soon as we see any indicators of slowdown from our customer demands. So we are developing to meet the demand of our customers, and we're not speculating that we build them, they will come. Land sourcing continues to be a challenge. It's getting harder and harder to secure good sites. As I mentioned earlier, we've seen a decrease of 18% of industrial land released in the system year over year. Since the closing of a China consortium 9 months ago, we have seen a lot of support and help from the consortium, not only helping providing us the lowest cost of debt, but also help us access introduction and helps close land sites. A little over 20% of land sites have been closed as a result of the consortium's help. We expect that to continue to be a competitive advantage going forward. As I go around the world meet investors over the last few months, consistently one of the questions asked was that we understand why you had to do the consortium deal to strengthen your position, but do we expect another such transaction? I can sit here and tell you we do not expect to do this again. So this is something that we needed to do, and this is something that we have completed, and I'm very happy where we are, and we do not need to do it again. Let's go over to Japan. Again, the fundamental in Japan continue to be very strong. We witnessed a 99% leasing occupancy ratio in Japan. In some of the markets like Osaka, it's not just us doing well. The entire market is doing well. Vacancy for high-end products in Osaka is virtually vacancy is zero, pretty much. So Japan is one of my favorite markets. I would like to invest more in this market. But again, the constraint is getting access to land. Japan is very land-constrained, as you know. It is getting competitive. Local players are coming into the field. But we continue to, you know, we have the strongest team in Japan, 100% local nationals. And I'm very happy to report to you that this financial year we'll have our record development start of $1 billion. And as you've seen, witnessed the most recent development that we completed and sold into JREIT, we recorded a 30% development margin. Again, I don't expect this kind of margin to continue forever. For our own underwriting and budgeting purpose, we maintain a 25%. So we're going to try and enjoy it as long as possible. But again, I think 25% is still very healthy. For Brazil, you know, the news even worse than what you read about China. But interestingly, what we're witnessing in Brazil is that continuous strong leasing demand. We have done some of the strongest leasing in the last 2 quarters. And basically, because the GDP is not growing, doesn't mean people stop consuming, or it doesn't mean that they stop living their life. So what we're seeing is that on the ground, the demand for our facilities continue to be very strong. Also, we've seen some of the smart monies are start moving into this market because they believe that maybe this is an optimistic time to invest in Brazil. But again, we remain cautiously optimistic about this market, and for the mid to long term, we continue to be very committed to this market because what drives our business is population and consumption. And again, Brazil has one of the strongest local consumption markets, and so in the mid to long term, we still have complete confidence in this market, and we'll continue to invest in this market. Currently, it makes up about 6% of our NAV, and we will continue to leverage our fund management platform to grow in this market. On the U.S., we complete one of the largest transactions using our fund management platform of $8 billion of asset in February. We acquired the portfolio with a significant discount to replacement costs, and since we acquired the asset, cap rate in the U.S. have moved 25 to 50 basis points in our favor. We continue to see very strong rental growth. You know, when Steve go over the portfolio numbers with you on the renewal rents, those numbers you wouldn't expect them out of the U.S. It's more like emerging market, you know, double digit on rental renewals. Leasing continue to be strong. Since we acquired the portfolio, we have improved from 89% to 92%. And again, overall, the market in the U.S. continue to be very healthy supply and demand. What we're seeing is that net absorption is about twice that of supply. So U.S. markets continue to be quite healthy. And last, I think on most people's mind would be, when are you guys going to complete the syndication? I'm happy to share with you is that the syndication with our partners are in final legal documentation phases, and we expect to come back to you with the news of new investors in our U.S. Portfolio. And with that, I will hand over to Steve to go over the operations.
Thanks, Ming. I'm going to run through the operational highlights in each of our markets for both the fourth quarter as well as the year end, and I'll start with China on slide 4. Two key drivers of our business, of course, are leasing and developments, and we posted record numbers in both for the year. As Ming mentioned, in the fourth quarter, we had 1.2 million square meters of leasing, which brought our lease ratio to 91%, and our full-year leasing to 3.1 million square meters, which is up 36% year-on-year. Our renewal rental rate growth was at about 5.5%, and our same property NOI growth was at 7%. Really, it continues to be driven. The demand is driven by the same customers we've been talking about for some time now, which is e-commerce, retail, fast-moving consumer goods, and auto parts. On the heels of very strong leasing activity, we also had a lot of development going on this year, obviously. And in the fourth quarter, we had $581 million U.S. dollars of starts, which is up 35%, bringing the total year to about $1.64 billion in total starts, which is up 42% year-on-year. Our completions were $516 million U.S. in the fourth quarter, and for the full year, they were $1 billion. And going forward, we have starts projected to be $2.2 billion U.S. and completions at $1.4 billion, both up in excess of 30% year-on-year. And as with prior years, our completions for the year will be more on the back end, with probably 80% happening in the second half of the year. You know, we're generating, obviously, tremendous lease volume, and we have a lot of development activity. And I think it makes sense to ask, so why does that all matter? And, you know, intrinsically, I think it makes sense, but really what it does is it serves another key tenet of our platform that we have in China, which we've talked about before, which is the network effect, which we touch on page 5. Put simply, scale generates exponential activity as opposed to doing deals on a lease-by-lease basis. And by creating blanket coverage, which we have over all of China, the key markets of China, Frankly, we become the call that customers are making when they're looking to roll out a program. In fact, very often we're collaborating with customers both on current needs as well as their needs in the future. We're partnering with our customers in advance. And I think the numbers bear that out. 61% of our new leases this year were with existing customers. In over half of our lease area, we have customers who had multi-market locations. And if you look at JD.com, as just one example, they quadrupled their space with us in the last year and have gone from 1 to 10 cities in just 3 years and now serve as one of our top customers, representing about 3.7% of leased area. And, in fact, we have 20 customers that are in over 5 cities with us. Depon and Best Logistics are in 20 different locations. Sonitrans and Schenker are in over 10, and Hire is now in over 5. And so really it just gives further evidence that scale begets scale. And we think that with our breadth and depth in key markets, that it provides us with, frankly, a very unique competitive advantage that cannot be replicated. The way we get the network effect, of course, is driven by something which we talk about all the time, and that's land. And we touch on that on slide 6. We've spoken about it a lot before, and we're going to continue to do so because the scarcity is absolutely becoming a significant barrier to entry. So we've had, you know, government issuances down 20%, government sales down 20% over the year. In some of our key markets, there were actually zero land quotas granted for the year. I mean, it's a very simple business that starts with the dirt. And if you don't have the dirt, any plans to expand or grow in China will just remain plans. And through the efforts of our team, we actually are very fortunate to still have over 12 million square meters of land reserve on the books. And as Ming has mentioned, the consortium and our relationship with the consortium has taken our ability to access land to another level, so much so that over the next few years, we're projecting $6.4 billion in development starts. So with record leasing, very strong rental and NOI growth, record completions, and an unparalleled scale, we feel like we're very well situated to capture significant market share on an ongoing basis. Next, I'll touch on Japan on page 7. You know, Japan has been a key part of our portfolio and will remain such going forward. In the fourth quarter, we leased 88,000 square meters, which is up over 70% year on year. And for the year, we leased 350,000 square meters, with average portfolio rental up 1% year on year. 53% of those leases were to existing customers, again, kind of with the same trend that we see in China. We have a stabilized lease ratio of 99%, and in the last year, we met both our start and completion targets for the fiscal year, with $661 million in starts and $55 million in completions. Currently, we have $1.3 billion under development today, and as Ming mentioned, in the ensuing year, we are going to have just under $1 billion in starts and $720 million in completions. 30% of those are pre-leased. So given the efforts of the team, we are very excited by the opportunities that we have, that we see in Japan coming up in the next year. Turning to Brazil on page 8, despite a lot of the negative news, we have seen some very strong leasing activity. And we are managing our starts with our lease up as we wind through some of the economic headwinds. In fact, our stabilized lease ratio in Brazil is 97%. And in the fourth quarter, we leased 108,000 square meters of new and expansion space. And our rent renewal growth has been about 6.7%, with same property rental growth up just about 6%. For the year, we project $240 million in starts and $140 million of completions. And a lot of that will be driven with in the land that we recently acquired in Cajamar, which is one of the key logistics hubs in Sao Paulo of 76,000 square meters. So we're going to continue to employ a tailored approach in Brazil. We think the long-term fundamentals remain very strong. You still have a market that is served by 80% obsolete or outdated buildings. And so we feel long-term that Brazil remains a very viable market. And lastly, I'll talk about the U.S. on slide 9. We only completed the acquisition, obviously, in February, and as Ming has mentioned, the syndication is imminent. The portfolio itself is performing as we expected, which is very strong. It's up. The leasing is occupancy is 92%. It's up over 200 basis points since we started negotiating the deal. Net effective rents are up 11.8% since our acquisition. and we have an 85% retention ratio. And our same-store cash NOI growth year-on-year is about 6.8%. Even with that, I think the more compelling thing is the macro conditions that still exist in the U.S. So first, within our own portfolio, the average in-place rents remain about 7% below market. You have strong economic indicators coming out of the U.S. You have 20 consecutive quarters of positive lease absorption that's still being driven by e-commerce, manufacturing, output, and trade volumes, which are all very favorable, that we think will perform very well for us going into 2016. So in sum, we have solid operational momentum across all of our markets on the heels of strong and record leasing and development activity in China, a growing network in China. We remain very excited and optimistic about things in 2016. And with that, I'll turn it over to Heather.
Thanks, Steve. I will go over some financials on page 11. First, I'll touch on the result for the quarter. Our revenue is up 6% to $167 million. The main drivers, obviously, are the China completion and lease up. The China revenue is up 19%. That's partially offset by the J-REIT impact for this quarter, as well as the Japanese yen depreciation. On PATMI, we're down 34% to $105 million, mostly driven, as you know, the Chinese construction impact for the full quarter, as well as the J-REIT and the Japanese yen depreciation. That's the upside was obviously the China operation performance, as both me and Steve mentioned before. We did recognize FX gain, $26 million this time. That's really driven by reclassification of some intercompany borrowings. That will be a one-time impact. Pro forma PATMI extra valuation up 10% on the back of strong operation results and the further expansion of our fund management platform. The China pro forma PATMI extra valuation grew by 33% year on year. I also want to touch upon some of the one-time items in the quarter. The $26 million FX that I mentioned already, and then there's also FX impact, positive impact on the Brazilian fund fees. That's about $6 million, and that's partially offset by China loan repayment impact, $12 million. This quarter, we also recognized $27 million at partner level Brazil revaluation losses due to cap rate expansion in that country. There is also a one-time cost that we recognize in the U.S., a transaction-related, that's about $6 million. On the full-year result, the PATMI is down 29% to $486 million. That's mostly the China consortium impact, the J-REIT as FX, as we see in the prior quarters. Pro forma earnings, excluding revaluation, is up 31%. This obviously is the pro forma will always adjust to the China consortium, the FX, the J-REIT, and some significant one-time items, as you see in the past couple quarters. So pro forma earnings, excluding revaluation, is up 31%, mostly driven by the China strong operation performance. China pro forma earnings actually up 33%. We also have the impact, positive impact from Brazil because we did hold BR property for a little over half a year. So we recognized 100% earnings for that period. Since this is the first quarter that we completed the U.S. acquisition, so I want to talk a little bit about accounting treatment as well as the financial impact for this quarter and touch on a little bit what we see for the whole year. For U.S. accounting, even though we own 55%, because we ultimately will own 10% only, so this is not consolidated in our financial statements, We recognize the 45% as asset held for sale on the balance sheet. We'll only pick up 10% of earnings from this portfolio. So for this quarter, you will see we recognize the fee income, about $4 million, the G&A, including some of the one-offs, $6 million, and the earning pickup, actually a loss because there's some one-time transaction-related costs. So it's negative income, impact $3.7 million for this quarter. However, for this whole year, we're looking at an estimation of recognizing $22 million from operations, plus accumulated earnings that we will recognize when we complete the syndication for the 45%. Then lastly, as Steve mentioned, the cap rate compression that's to come. So that will be the full year impact with financials for the U.S. operation. Turn to slide 12 on the leverage and cash. We remain have very strong balance sheet, a strong cash position, $1.4 billion cash. After completion of syndication, we'll have another $1.5 billion coming back. So the net debt actually is zero, offset the total borrowings after syndication. The net debt to assets at 10% on a look-through basis, again, after U.S. syndication. We do operate in multiple countries, therefore exposed to different currencies, including especially yen and riyal, that you have seen in the last couple quarters has a pretty significant impact. We believe in natural hedge, so some of those impacts are partially offset by our debt financing in those countries denominating local currency, and we'll continue to do that. In this quarter alone, we have signed agreement for a total of $40 billion yen, or about $330 million U.S. dollars, which serves as a natural hedge for our net exposure in Japan. With global currency markets likely to remain volatile, we'll continue to adopt a prudent and proactive approach toward capital management. I want to touch a little bit on our capital expenditure as well. Last year, we invested $2 billion on operations. That's after adjusting the U.S. syndication. Including syndication, actually, we did $3.5 billion. 60% of that went to China. So that shows our continued commitment. We'll see that trend continue this year and in future years. With RMB bond perpetual securities up for redemption over the next 2 years, and also looking at the current low interest environment, we will explore a possibility looking at providing more long-term and low-income financing to support our growth. With that, I'll hand back to me.
Well, thank you, Heather. I'm looking forward to this year's June and September earnings results because hopefully by then we don't have this none of this performer excuses why we're down because of dilution and all that. So I'm glad we're going to be having that behind us and continue to show the result of the hard work of our employees and our colleagues on the ground. We're actually seeing 30%+ growth on the operating front. But again, when it's translated down to the bottom line, it doesn't show. So when it comes to June and September, I'm looking forward to those earnings calls. Here, I'd like to walk through how we make money. I think that's what it's all about, right? So we continue to be creating a lot of value through development. And if you look at this slide here, we give Copenicia as an example because this is the most recent transaction we crystallized and sold into the J-REIT. Basically, we created a margin about 38%. Within 14 months, the net IRR was 128%. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we don't expect this kind of margin to continue forever. But again, we believe that 25% is very achievable in the foreseeable future. So, and all on the underwriting we assume on average on a company about 25% EBITDA margin. Obviously, different market will have much higher than that. If you look at our pipeline for the next few years, we're looking at $8 billion development pipeline, and this is all driven by the demand, the backlog of a customer demand. And Heather mentioned that we have cash, you know, we have cash about $1.5 billion. Based on our current development pipeline and customer demands, we're looking over the next 12 months, we will be at zero cash position. So this perception that we have a lot of cash on hand is actually very, very short term. So to meet the customer demand and to capture these opportunities, we can leverage, borrow more, or we do some of that and be conservative and leverage other people's equity. So that's where the fund model comes in. So if you look at the development, the pipeline of $8 billion, we're going to leverage the fund model, leverage the upper equity. Our net net exposure, that is about 45% of the $8 billion. And with that, we will capture $1 billion of development profit over the next 3 years. That's our share of equity at risk and return for $1 billion. On top of that, we get about $400 million of fees and promote from managing our partners' money. So with that, maybe I can walk through on the next slide 15, to give an illustration. You know, if we have $100 we develop, and we assume a 50% leverage, and we probably make 25% on average, so we make 25%, that translated to $25 of development margin, pretty straightforward. But if we have opportunity that is more than $100, which is the case right now, our customer demand is far greater than that, and the market opportunity is far greater than that. And as Steve mentioned, the network effect, having a large coverage, is becoming more and more competitive advantage to us. So we want to have more coverage and meet our customer demands. So if the opportunity is $200, and so here we leveraged our fund partners, $100, we get to, you know, our ownership is, let's say, 45%. And we get to a total development opportunity of $220. And based on the 25% development margin, we create about a 25% for our money, and then $3 for the fees, and the expected $10 from the promote. So for the same $100 we put at risk, if it's with all our money, we create $25 in value, but if we leverage the fund partner's money, we actually create $38 in value. So again, on the same equity at risk, we have 50% higher return for the capital. So again, it's not just purely from a return enhancement standpoint, but it actually increases our competitiveness in the market to meet our customer demand, have a larger footprint, and leveraging that the network effect and be more competitive. So again, that's what we'll be focusing on going forward. In Japan, we start recycling assets after development into stabilized portfolios, and that create more AUM under management. We expect that to roll out in other countries. Also, we'll do that in China as well. Right now, we've been capturing a lot of upside and development on our own balance sheet. But as I mentioned to you, $1.5 billion cash, we expect the zero cash balance in 12 months' time. So to fund future development, we have to recycle asset. So you will see that it's going to be part of the program going forward as well. And on the next slide, it gives you a snapshot of our current fund management platform and how do we view the value that we created. We started the fund management business 3-4 years ago, and we've been averaging pretty much 97% annual growth rate over the last few years. And now we have $108 million just from the fees from last year. And this year we expect to be about 150. As I mentioned, we expect to be another 50% growth next year to over $230 million just in fees. With the fees of assuming 50% margin, you put a 15% multiple on it, that give us about $1.1 billion in the fees in the value. And we estimate that the NPV of the promote that are in the money today, about $400 million. So today we see a $1.5 billion value that we have created over the last 3 years. Again, that translates to about 40 cents per share. I guess with that, I will hand off to Ambika for questions.
Thanks, everyone, for joining today. What we'll do is, again, on the webcast, we'll be asking questions via the webcast, and those who are on the phone, please log in through via webcast because we're not accepting questions via the call today. So let's first start out in person with the crowd, and then also feel free to email your questions to me as well.
Hey, Ming, Paul from Goldman Sachs. Again, first of all, congratulations on the wonderful set of results. Leasing has been very strong in China. Can you just touch a little bit on the incentives that you had to, you know, give to drive that kind of numbers?
Okay, so the question was the leasing has been very strong in China, and what kind of incentive do we have to give in order to move the people, the customer in? Actually, what we've seen over the last 3 to 4 years, it's been pretty consistent, is that on average, we give about 1 year of free rent to our customers to move them in. And some of that is intentional, created by us. Think about this. If I'm negotiating with my customer and the maximum rent they want to pay at that market is $1, and I say, okay, we agree to $1, but can we strike at $110, but I give you 1 month free rent, and let's start at $110. So maybe the absolute is still $1, but I start at $110. 3 years later, my basis is $110 plus 5% plus 5% plus 5%. Instead of $1 plus 5% plus 5%. And you know what? During the process of 3 years, a lot of managers come and go. They forgot why it was 110 instead of 1 to start with. So that's the rationale behind why we give free rent.
Thank you.
Okay, let me answer you in reverse orders about the U.S. So, you know, unfortunately, these investors and partners were together with us when we identified opportunity in the U.S. So we reached an agreement to commit to buy into that portfolio. And due to the CFIUS filing, we had to close it first to do the filing, and then the other investors come in as a second tranche to do a separate filing because of the tight closing time frame. Because of our commitment from the beginning, we have an obligation to stick to the original agreed price. So the only thing upside we enjoy here is the rent we receive from this period of time. So I guess a downside upside scenario is that the legal team got in dispute and the investor fall apart, and then we can
syndicate at current market price, but I would say that does not going to happen. Unfortunately, we are, you know, we were committed to that price. But, you know, that's the reason why investors work with us, is that we are more focused on long-term relationships. It's not a transactional type of relationships. So, yes, legally, technically, we probably make the most money in the short term if we ignore the commitment to our existing lineup of investors and go out and just market the portfolio at current market price. We will be in the money at least 10% compared to what was when we contracted. I'm sorry. Okay. On an absolute basis, if we can give you a breakdown, but we're averaging about 30% annual growth from the annual basis of this year and next year. So we can come back on the because we will be mixing. As I mentioned, our own capital cannot meet the demand of our customers. So we were expecting to raise a future development fund as the current logistic fund one in China. Is completely invested, and we will expect to have a second fund to continue to support that.
Sean, just going back to your question, I think we're maybe mixing concepts between starts and completions. So actually, FY16 completions are $1.4 billion. So if you basically increase that by approximately 30% a year, then you get to the number that we're talking about. So the implicit $8 billion number that we're talking about, that assumes approximately completions and approximately 30% growth within China. Yeah, that's the completion. That's talking about... to say it another way, it's FY16, 17, 18 completions.
Hi, Ming. This is Kang Ho from BNP. Congratulations on your results. Just two questions. The first one is the last results briefing, I remember you mentioned about the potential redevelopment of some of your projects, I think initiated by the government within the Tier 1 cities. Can you give us a bit of update on that? And secondly is for your construction completion, not sure whether I heard wrongly that it's likely more back-end loaded within the fiscal year. Can you just explain a little bit why this is the kind of the pattern that we are seeing? Okay, thank you.
Yes, historically we have been back-end loaded on both completion and leasing on the third and fourth quarter. And again, at the beginning, it started with the holiday, Chinese New Year period, and then the start pickup, and then the completion falls in the fourth quarter. It just kind of get into this cycle, and that's something that we are very focused on to get a more balance to each quarter. So actually, starting this year, we actually didn't rush to complete some of the projects on the fourth quarter and just let it run into the first quarter and slowly balancing that out, because it's not the best use of resources to rush on the fourth quarter. And then also put pressure to lease up in one quarter with all this new completion. So we acknowledge that that's an issue, that was something that it just got into a vicious cycle that it kind of compounded over the last 2-3 years. And so that's something that we're very much focusing on, and it would take us a couple of years to smooth out into more even among the quarters. So on the opportunity on the redevelopment, again, when we underwrite a project, we do not assume the potential rezoning or upside. We just underwrite based on the cash flow from the warehousing. But because the urbanization is happening so fast in China, what used to be suburbs now become very much part of the city. We have probably on average about 15% of our 15 to 20% of our parks are surrounded by high-rise residentials. Some of the projects are being asked by the government to rezone into other uses because the truck traffics congesting the neighbors, and they actually getting complaints from the residents nearby. That presents a very high upside for us. To obviously, as a landowner, we have the first right to develop that site. And we've also seen very favorable policies coming out from startup in Shenzhen, copying Hong Kong, and then now we're seeing that in Shanghai and Beijing, basically giving the existing landowners, industrial lands, the first right to redevelop and also access to the site at a discount to what the market value is. So we have a couple projects that are under development phases, one in Beijing and one in Shanghai. The value we have on the book versus what we can create from the redevelopment is quite the delta is quite significant. We are most likely not going to be do it alone. We're going to try to partner with people that are the best in those disciplines, and we participate and learn and enjoy the upside being a landowner. But I would expect that to continue to occur over time.
Hi, this is Donald from Merrill Lynch. Just two questions. First is on China. Could you give us some color on the land acquisition from the consortium, margins, which tier of cities, and from which companies have you been acquiring from the consortium? That's the first question. Second is just to clarify on U.S. There was a report recently that GLP was interested in the KTR portfolio, which was ultimately sold to Prologis. Could I clarify on this, on GLP's initial interest, if that's true? And if it's true, do you see this as an opportunity lost, or are you indifferent about the portfolio being sold to other parties?
On the KTR, so what was reported in the media was absolutely false. We did not participate in the process, bidding process. We were aware of the transaction. We were aware of the portfolio, but it was very close to the timing of our transaction, so we did not consider and give a serious look. So what was reported in the media was not true. On the land contributed by a consortium, as I mentioned, about 20% of the land that we acquired over last year has been directly refer to us or help us negotiate and get access to some of the sites. As far as the breakdown, I'm not sure if it's disclosed in the supplement, but Imbica can give you the details on the site per site basis. But on the margins, I would say that we probably on average probably enjoy a 10% discount to the market. On the price because of the relationship we enjoy. I would say some of the land areas that we can buy into is more of a availability not necessarily price, because there may be a price but there's no land quota available in the area. And whereas going forward you're going to hear us talk about the next focus area to invest is going to be a cluster of population. And you're not going to see us distinguishing first-tier city, second-tier city, because the mindset in the past is second-tier, and third-tier. That is the traditional mindset about distribution, because in the old days, I'd say like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, the model of traditional retail has been focused on first, second-tier, because that's where the retail outlets are. But if you look at it, most of our business coming from these days are e-commerce. E-commerce are clustered around populations and consumptions. So a lot of the traditional retail outlets may not have reached the second tiers, but actually it doesn't matter because they already skipped. They started buying online. So you will see that we will start focusing on population basis, because at the end of the day, it's a functional purpose, and it's population consumption that drives the use of a facility. So so that's where our thoughts about where we're going to invest. It's going to be where's the population and where the transportation hub is going to be.
Yeah. Sorry, just a follow-up on that. So can we say that the land acquisition from the consortium is closer to 30% development margins instead of 25%, which you normally get? This is about 10% discount.
Well, land's only one-third of the Yeah, so, you know, on the margin, you may get like a 2% increase. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi, Joy from Deutsche Bank. Two questions from me. First, just a clarification on slide 14. I think you mentioned about $8 billion of development completion, development pipeline. For the funding of that, do you need to raise additional funds or the current funds will be sufficient to, you know, develop all these. Second question is regarding on China. You mentioned about, 8 million square meters of demand backlog. I mean, you've been doing this for a while. How have you seen competition pulling away your pipeline, and what sort of conversion from the pipeline to actual demand have you seen over, you know, the last year, especially under the current competition environment? Thank you.
On the $8 billion development pipeline, as I mentioned, we have cash position $1.5 billion, and we expect that to be the $1.5 billion is. We also have a China Development Fund is in place already, so our share of that is 56%. So, on top of that, anything that's done outside the logistic fund is also 100% on our own balance sheet. We expect that to be spent over the next 12 months. Also, China Logistics Fund will be fully invested in that period of time as well. So, to fund the future, future development, we will need to set up a new fund in China, and to pick up continue from the first fund. And also, you will see us need to recycle some asset in order to fund future development as well.
That's basically will increase your gearing. If you use off all your cash, your gearing wouldn't go up to your.
We expect also over the next next 12, 18 months, it'll probably go up to 30% in China.
Yeah, a little bit.
So I think we said that 30 to 40% is what we feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Any indication on the fund size that you want to raise?
I would say it's going to be probably equity around $3 billion, and with a development size about $6 billion. And, you know, one of the things that I want to share with you about going forward our communication style is that in the past we take pride and just do it and don't talk about it. And I think the feedback is that, yeah, that's very nice, but don't surprise us. So going forward, we will be communicating a little bit more and share with you our thoughts, what we're actually doing and planning. So that's why here I'm sharing with you that we will, because in the past, our mindset is that, you know, too many people talk about, never do anything. So we just say, you know, we don't talk about it, we just do it and let results speak for itself. But I think there's a balance. So going forward, we're going to share with you what we're going to do next 3 years and measure us by that, and this is what we're going to do this year, next year, and the year after that.
Okay, we have a question from the webcast. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, the other question about the demand.
The demand, actually, every time we convert new the demand into real, and then the new backfill comes in. So on average, probably about a two-third of the backlog convert into real orders.
Okay,
have two questions from YK from CLSA, so I'll just ask them together and we can then split them out. The first one is, do you expect cap rates from your China portfolio to compress further, and by how much? And the other question is, can you share your experience from the JD.com expansion within your China portfolio? Are customers taking smaller or larger spaces compared to 2 years ago, and how has the lease length changed? And are tenants getting more rent incentives?
We expect cap rate, even before the interest rate come down to 25 basis point in China to 5.1, even before that happened, we were expecting 25 basis point cap rate compression. So I would say the answer is yes. We probably can still see a further 25, potentially 50 basis point cap rate compression. On the JD.com, to share experience, we're seeing that there are two extremes. What we're seeing is that customers that used to lease 3,000, 6,000 square meters per leases now coming to us for 20,000, 30,000 per lease per transaction. And also the space they require are much bigger. It's moving towards more of the big box concept we see in the U.S. and in Europe. For operating efficiency for a regional distribution center, you know, if possible, they want to have, you know, 50,000 square meters, 100,000 square meters per warehouse. And but the fire code in China these days currently doesn't allow you to build a box that's bigger than 24,000 square meters. Basically, four component of 6,000 square meter each. We are pushing and lobbying to make that change. So we actually got invited by the Shanghai Fire Bureau and to participate in a study. We're the only one that got invited in the country to basically to share what is the international best practice and what should be reconsidered. So hopefully we can, as a market leader, as an industry leader, we can push that to get to more international standards and create a bigger box and be more efficient for our customers. And when I say another extreme is that besides the big box for regional regional distribution, our customers also looking for smaller, closer to city for the last mile drop off and delivery driven by the e-commerce and online offline business model. So those are the two trends we're seeing. And the other what's the other part of the question? Yeah. As I already answered the rent incentive in earlier. Yeah. So basically, we on average we're giving about 1 month per year on the rent incentive for customers to move in.
Any other questions from the audience?
Good morning, Wei Xing from the Mentan Securities. I'd like to ask you about the incentive. You mentioned that you give 1 month free in China, but your average lease years is only like 2 years, 2 to 3 years. So it's like it's more worth it to do it in Japan where the lease is 5 years. So, I mean, how are you going to capture your customers with such a short lease?
Historically, the customer's been growing at 30% annually. So if they lease with us, typically 3 years is the typical lease in China. So if you think about it, if the business is growing 30% a year, for them to commit to a space, if it's longer than 3 years, that means that the first year is going to be majority sitting empty if they have any kind of growth. So it's hard for them to commit to a longer-term period. We have customers like Adidas, Walmart, the one that you know have more precise planning. They commit to 10 years, but even they are wrong. Usually, when they commit to 10-year leases, usually in the third year or fourth year, they come back and say, "Sorry, we need more spaces and we need to renegotiate a bigger space." And so it's more of the dynamic and growth of the business that they cannot commit to a longer period, and also. We put in a fixed annual increases into our leases each year. So we do capture the upside each year. Right now, about 5%. In some of the markets, we expect where it's oversupply, that probably go down to 4% on the annual escalation on the rent. But if you look at the renewals when they expire, in China we have over 70% renewal with us, and the other 30%, some of that is because they need spaces that we cannot satisfy, so they had to move out of the park or to go find new spaces.
Okay, great.
I still have another question, which is regarding to short sellers. I noticed that you mentioned that there's the 8 billion pipeline and you will be looking to increase your gearing. So that could invite short sellers to attack you. So do you have any contingency plans to fight the short sellers if they were to pop up?
I don't even know where to begin about that. But I would say our shareholders that like us will fight them.
Thank you.
We have a question from the webcast. So before Donald, I'll just ask this one. It's for Steve. Just investors asking about our expansion plans within the U.S.
Well, as Ming alluded to earlier, we are built for growth, and the fund management platform is obviously something that we look to grow and will continue to expand. But before I talk about expanding in the U.S., I mean, we always take two steps back and say that, you know, our first priority by far is absolutely to finish the syndication. And the second priority is to make sure that we continue to grow leasing. You know, we're currently at 92%. We anticipate getting that to 94% in a relatively short term. Those are our two primary focuses. Now, you heard Ming and I talk about it. We do think the U.S. is still a very strong market, a good market, and it is something that we would look to expand in the future through the fund vehicle. But today we remain focused just on executing on our existing platform.
I just want to add one thing is that we're very proud and with the team that we put together in the U.S., and the team is very scalable. So if we acquire additional, let's say, $2 billion asset, we will not need to increase the overhead much because the team's already a national coverage team. And all we need is basically some of the reporting. But the senior team, the market officers, we will not need to add any overhead to it. So it's a very scalable as well as profitable fund management business if we continue to add asset into it.
I think so. Three very, very quick questions. First is on U.S. syndication. Can we confirm that we are still on track for 10%? In August, as was initially guided? That's the first question. Second is, what is the transaction cost for the quarter for the U.S. portfolio that affected the bottom line, the one-time cost? Third is on your dividends. See that there's a 22% increase in dividend payout, which is nice. Can we expect this to continue to rise as your operational income increases? And is there a target payout that we can think about? Thank you.
Okay, on the syndication, from the beginning we said that end of August we will have a syndication completed. I'm happy to share with you is that we're in the final legal documentation phases. I would say that we should be able to announce a binding agreement within weeks, if not days. So, I'm happy to share with you. Yes, we are on schedule and we will have the syndication done before August. But again, we need to go through a CFIUS filing in the U.S. So for a CFIUS filing committee of foreign investment in the U.S., that need to go through a procedural, which we don't expect to. It's more of a procedural process that would take probably how long?
Usually 60 days.
Yeah, 60. So once we sign a binding agreement, we need to go through 60 days of approval by the U.S. government. Maybe Heather, you can answer the second one.
On the one-time cost that impact our this quarter financials for the U.S. is about $6 million.
And then on the dividend, we don't have a declared per se dividend policy. What we said was that we want to maintain a sustainable payout of dividends. And one thing you see is that as we continue to focus to grow our fund management platform, the fees from the fund management is a recurring, sustainable, and it's going to become a bigger and bigger part of our income. I would say that in the long term, I expect one day we'll get the same amount of fees as the underlying rental income from our rent of our portion equity. So, yes, to answer your question, we expect that cash flow from operation and from the fee management to continue to grow, and that we're able to maintain or grow our dividends. So that's our position.
Morning, Ming. It's Michael from UBS. Just like to get some color on the China revenues. If I look at the lease area, the stabilized portfolio, the effective rents, they've all been growing quarter on quarter. However, if you look at the revenues, they've been relatively flat. Is that a function of timing or the rent-free areas, rent-free periods that you talk about, or is there more something, some other factors affecting it?
Okay. So, There are also another elements, occupancy and leasing. There's a delta in the timing because a lot of these customers that come into Austin say, I want 8 cities, and in one month they come to say, we need 8 cities. But I want to tie up all these spaces. But I don't need these locations until, you know, 3-4 months later. But they leverage the 8 cities in one go. So we do have some cities where we actually sign the lease, but they have like a lagging 2-3 months before they even moving in. So from that standpoint, we cannot charge them rent until the move-in day as part of the agreement. So you get some of that lagging behind.
And also many of the completions, therefore the leasing and moving in, is toward quarter end. So if you look at the quarter or the last quarter, obviously it wouldn't have that impact. And the other thing is we do have some one-off. For example, we had a rent from a lease termination that we recognized last quarter. That's not repeatable. That's about $2 million. We also have fees that we received for managing a minority or joint control entity. That's not repeatable. So there's some one-offs as well. You take that off, and most of the impacts are from the timing.
And we'll just... this will be the last question, and we'll wrap it up.
Right, Heather, just on the one-off cost you spoke about, there's the $6 million in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And just from these together, I lost track. You said there's some in Brazil, there's some in China. What I'm trying to understand is you have $66 million of clean net income in Q2and $39 million, which is excluding the FX. So just that $26 million drop-off. What are the costs we should try to take out?
Yeah, out of that, there's $6 million from U.S. that we often mentioned. Also, in the last quarter, we had almost a few months of APR property under our ownership, so that earnings impact about $6 million as well. That's not repeatable this quarter after we sell down, obviously. There's a J-REIT that there's a dividend, $6 million, that's not happening every quarter. That's about 18. Then there's some gains from disposal tax refund that's roughly the cost of this.
Okay, we just want to thank everyone for joining us, and I'll hand it to Ming for some closing comments.
Well, first of all, thank you for joining us. Again, across our key markets, we continue to see strong demand, and we're able to see strong rental growth in all the markets we operate in. One of the things that you will see us is continue to focus on recycling assets to fund our future capital requirement, and we started that in Japan, and we'll continue that into China. One thing we will continue to do better and more focus on is streamline our messaging, clearly spill out our strategy for the next 3 years, and what are the plans going forward. And with our market-leading position, experienced management team, and solid balance sheet position, I think we're well capitalized to, you know, grow our business. And, again, thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.